And then there were five. India's victory at Edgbaston ended Bangladesh's hopes of making the semi-finals. Rohit Sharma, who hit his fourth century of the World Cup, and Jasprit Bumrah, who took 4 for 55 and showed his class again at the death, the star performers in a 28-run win. The win confirms India's spot in the last four alongside Australia, leaving England, New Zealand and Pakistan to battle it out for the final two places. Welcome to the Wisden Extra podcast in partnership with Betfair Exchange, our weekly Bumper World Cup show discussing what we've seen over the past week and looking ahead to the final stretch of the tournament. I'm your host Joe Harmon, and with me today are two journalists who've been travelling all over the country over the course of the World Cup. We have South African writer Daniel Gallen, who I'm sure regular listeners will be familiar with by now. Hi Dan.
Hey Joe, good to see you.
And English correspondent for CricBuzz, Rob Johnston. Rob, I think last time we had you on the show, it was after a washout, not a ball bowled. It's a nicer setting at the Oval this evening, and some cricket to talk about.
Yep, much nicer. Good to be here.
Thanks, Rob. As usual, we'll come on to the Bangladesh-India game, but we're going to start with what each of us have learned over the past week. Dan, I'm going to come to you first. What have you learned over the past week of cricket?
I've learned that the World Cup brings out the stereotypes in every side. South Africa, pretty rubbish at World Cups, turn it on when the World Cup is not on the line. Australia, rubbish for 3 years, turn it on when the World Cup is on the line. England insecurities come out in major tournaments. India are bad losers. Pakistan are erratic and yet somehow galvanize themselves. The West Indians aren't really too bothered by it. Bangladesh are pretty good, but not good enough. Yeah, I just like that this tournament really gives us a neat summation of what each side is.
Yeah, I can see that. I hadn't thought of it that way. You haven't mentioned the word choke with South Africa there. Is that
deliberately?
Does this even qualify as a choke? Because no, they didn't get to the point where they could choke, really.
No, if they were a little bit better, I think they would have choked eventually. I say that tongue-in-cheek. No, in fairness, this isn't a very good side. Faf du Plessis has said multiple occasions that this is perhaps the weakest side that has come to a tournament. So, No, not a choke. People on Twitter will disagree with that, I'm sure.
Rob, what have you learned over the course of the past week?
I think I've learned that Avishka Fernando, Sri Lanka's young 21-year-old batsman, absolutely looks the real deal. He scored 49 against England, which, although Malinga sort of won them that game, his innings set it up and he took on Jofra Archer, and not many people have done that in the tournament. He got 30 against South Africa, and he played an on-drive off Rabada, and he held the pose. And not many people do that to Rabada, and it was just a moment, and I thought, oh, he looks a good player. And then he obviously scored 100 yesterday, and that was 100 of ebb and flow. It wasn't a thrash or a one-paced innings. He had to take his time at the start and then kick off. So he looks the real deal. I guess the one worry you've got is, will Sri Lankan cricket manage him right? And I think that's a question for him. He's got to keep his performance levels up as well, but he looks such a good player. Just watching him and some of the shots he plays are just magical.
There's obviously no doubt at all that he's got the talent. That is absolutely clear. We have seen Kushal Mendes hasn't really kicked on from making some unbelievable innings at the start of his career. You'd hope with Avishka Fernando that he can kick on, because they need him in that test team immediately, don't they? I don't think he's got much of a record to speak of, particularly in first-class cricket, but he's obviously got the talent, so they'll get him in quickly.
Yeah, that's right, and he's already sort of been mistreated by the selectors. So I think he was 18, he played a game against Australia. Mitchell Starc, I think, got him out LBW for naught, and then he was just dropped after that, so he played one game, which is not the way to treat an 18-year-old. But he just looks technically to have it. But yeah, the question is, actually with all those young Australian, Sri Lankan batsmen are, you know, can they now kick on? It's okay averaging 30, but can you average 40 and 50? So yeah, he needs to be managed well, but it's up to him as well, I guess.
Yeah, I think Yaz said on the show yesterday that actually this World Cup owes a huge debt to Avishka Fernando, because if he hadn't played that innings against England and England had gone on to win that game, then all the permutations we've been talking about over the past couple of weeks wouldn't have really existed. We'd have had our top four, as most of us assumed that we did. And this might have been a slightly dull period of the World Cup waiting for the semi-finals to happen. As it's happened, we've had some really good games with a lot riding on them.
That's right. I mean, as you say, there was that fear that it was kind of just going to be a bit too neat and a bit too tidy halfway through the tournament, but yes, that Sri Lanka win really set it up. It's a pity that Bangladesh couldn't get one over India today. I mean, I don't think many people expected them to do so. At one point, as you say, it looked like it could have been tight, but if England, and we expect England to beat New Zealand, and I'm sure we'll get to that, but I think if they win that, does that wrap it up entirely? Is that the top four then sorted, no matter what happens with Bangladesh, Pakistan?
Well, it comes down to net run rate then, doesn't it? So if England beat New Zealand and Pakistan beat Bangladesh, then Pakistan will finish on the same number of points as New Zealand, but there'll be a big swing in net run rate that has to happen for Pakistan to leapfrog New Zealand, which, Rob, you were saying, it looks borderline impossible.
Yeah, I think it's it would take something miraculous to happen for that swing to be made up. So I think really, you know, if England win tomorrow, that's more or less Pakistan out, because, you know, even if they were to bowl out Bangladesh on Friday, I think, you know, they'd just be struggling to even make up that gap. So, yeah, big game for Pakistan tomorrow as well, actually.
So, yeah, the tournament really then wants New Zealand to win tomorrow. So we've got a classic between Pakistan and Bangladesh. Well, actually, we'll come on to England. Let's focus on today's game initially. Hang on, I haven't told you what I've learned as well.
What have you learned, Joe?
I need to do that as well. So I think it's been mentioned on the show that I've been at Glastonbury the last few days. So that's where my learning came from. I thought this actually yesterday as I was watching the West Indies Sri Lanka game, and if you guys are watching, you might have might have seen a brief glimpse of Rihanna. And when I say a brief glimpse, I mean kind of ball-by-ball coverage.
Yeah, exactly. Throughout that. Was Rihanna at the cricket?
Yeah, throughout that holdings. And it just struck me, whenever there's a star at the cricket fans get so excited, because in some way it's some sort of like validation of what we're all doing and what we're writing about or what we're watching, that, yes, outside of the bubble, people are watching.
Sorry to interrupt, because it also adds to what Jonathan Liu wrote in one of the columns for your magazine, said that cricket is never going to be cool. So yeah, when we see someone like Rihanna come to the cricket,
yeah,
it's almost like, well, can cricket be cool? But I mean, ultimately, our obsession with having a celebrity, our obsession, cricket's obsession with showing her ball by ball, kind of shows the insecurity of the sport, that kind of we will never be cool. We might be invited to a cool party, but we're never going to be the star of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And Rihanna is not actually what I've learned this week. Mine is a kind of juxtaposition of that. So while we saw Rihanna at the cricket, I saw Chris Wokes at Glastonbury, an unexpected sighting at the Pyramid Stage during Kylie on the Sunday Legend slot. Obviously not there in person. He was bowling a very good opening spell, I believe, against India on Sunday morning. But he was not who I was expecting to see that. I mean, you wouldn't really expect to see any England cricketer at Glastonbury on a big flag. Probably least of all Chris Wokes, and he's quite an unassuming, although very, very popular bloke. And I say popular, I sort of absentmindedly tweeted that from the audience, and then got home and saw that I'd had 2,000 likes.
Wow.
For this tweet.
Is that a record?
It's about kind of 1,990 more likes than I've got for any other tweet in my life. So, and again, that just showed, that was the flip side of it. So cricket fans love stars being interested in cricket. What they love even more than that is seeing cricket pop up in unexpected places, because that is real validation that actually it exists in the real world as well. So I think Chris Wokes, his flag, my tweet, proved all that to us, and was a nice man. I'd actually just been saying to a friend only about 5 minutes beforehand that if this was a Football World Cup, we'd have heard people talking about the World Cup throughout Glastonbury, as they were actually about the Women's Football World Cup.
I was going to ask, was that the only cricket reference that you saw at Glastonbury?
It wasn't mentioned at all. In fact, even my friend I was saying this to, I think, probably wasn't listening because he doesn't care about cricket at all. But then we see Chris Wokes 5 minutes later. It was mentioned as I was leaving England to beat in India. Heard that a couple of times. But other than that, you wouldn't have known it was going on. Which, you know, we've covered on this podcast a fair amount already, that right, it's not getting the cut through that we would like. The hope is that if England can beat New Zealand tomorrow and get into the semi-finals, then perhaps interest will rise a little bit as well. And right, I think, actually, people have talked about the Women's Football Cup almost being as a kind of, almost like a rival. We keep kind of comparing it and say they're getting 9 million for their game. Why aren't cricket getting this? Well, I think it can kind of create an interest in English sport as well. If the women's team go and win the Football World Cup, I think there can be a feel-good factor that could actually extend to the Cricket World Cup as well.
Yeah, and the potential would be that if England's women do win, they're playing tonight, right? If they do win that, and then they're playing in the World Cup final on Sunday, a week's time there'll be another potential World Cup final for England. So yeah, you've got a week, 7 days with potentially two World Cup finals, which would be great. There's a lot of sport to be played before that, but and obviously we've got the Women's Ashes going on as well in between. So I think, yeah, it would be great for everything to sort of, all those teams to be successful and really create a bit of a buzz, like the Football World Cup, the Men's Football World Cup last year.
And it's the sort of thing the press gets behind as well. You know, like when the Olympics is going on and medals start accumulating, then everyone gets involved in it. And I can kind of, hopefully, fingers crossed, see a similar effect in the cricket here.
It's interesting seeing different sports in competition with each other. To referenced Africa, as I will every chance I get in this pod, we kind of see it as, maybe because the national insecurity is so much greater than it is in England, we kind of see the success of the rugby side being a good thing for the footballers or being a good thing for the cricketers. And you often see the cricketers, you know, holding up signs and going to social media and wishing the other sports well. So it's interesting in this country, maybe because each sport commands so much attention in its own right, that there is a bit of a competition. I mean, does that play out in the way the fans see it? Do football fans see cricket fans or tennis now that's Wimbledon, do they see themselves as like elbowing each other out for space at the table?
I think the assumption is kind of that everyone's a football fan, and then you might like another sport as well. And that's kind of there's not many cricket journalists, for instance. Pretty much all the cricket journalists I know are massive football fans, support a club passionately, love cricket as well. But there's not too many people who I think kind of just love cricket. Right. Really.
Yeah, and I think you know, there's not been as much success as, I don't think we're that picky, frankly. I think
That's a very good point.
Whoever wins, if anybody wins, tiddlywinks, whatever, the country will get behind them. It's just a question of knowing that they're, you know, they have a chance. And I think it's always sort of a slow burn with England. So the group stages in any sport, it's like, oh yeah, okay, they're playing great. But as soon as they get through and, oh, they're two games away from winning or one game, you know, then suddenly everyone's like, oh yeah, suddenly I like tiddlywinks and I'll get involved and I'll take an interest in it. So I don't actually think, I think any sport, you know, the public just get behind. So I think if England can get in the Cricket World Cup into the semi-finals, I think that will actually swell. You know, it might not be swelling as much as we want, but I think it will swell. And hopefully if they get to the final, then that will, you know, kick off as well.
I think that's a really good point. There was a few years back, the curling at the Winter Olympics, and suddenly they got record viewing figures, even though it was on at kind of the early hours of the morning, and suddenly everyone was into curling. So cricket could be the new curling. That's what we've got to, we've got to hope for. Right, let's talk about some actual cricket that happened. India beat Bangladesh today. On the face of it, a relatively comfortable win, although there were moments there when I thought Bangladesh, particularly when Shakib and Mushfiqur Kerr were together, that they looked like they were going to give it a real, real good go. And even at the end, they pushed them to, 28 runs when it could have been 60 or 70 at one stage. So India are through. How do we think they're looking, though? Are there some frailties that their semi-final opponents, whoever they may be, will look to exploit and are there, obviously, to exploit?
Yeah, I mean, this India side is the India side that we've kind of come to expect. Another 100 from Rohit Sharma, another ton in the top three. Dhoni kind of doing his strange approach to batting towards the death, and their bowlers just bowling really well. It's just before the pod, I was just watching Bumrah bowl, who's just a joy to watch whenever he's got the ball in his hand. And they kind of they're winning cricket matches in the same way, aren't they? They're not really finding different ways to win, and maybe that's because Plan A is such an effective plan. But I do wonder that if they're going to come up again, you know, to bring it back to England, if they meet England on a good day, I do wonder if they have it in them to beat them. You kind of do wonder what India's plan B is. How else do they win cricket matches? So perhaps a worry, but like I said, maybe that's just a sign that Plan A is working really well.
You talk about Plan A, though. I mean, they've made a lot of changes to their side from the start of the tournament. I just listed a few. So in today's 11, they had Pant, Kartik and Shami, who have all come into the 11 since the start of the tournament. Dhawan obviously out injured, Shankar injured too. Kuldeep dropped today. Kedar Jadhav dropped today. Rahul's move from number four to open. That's a lot for a side that's potentially going to go on and win the tournament. That's a lot of changes to make over the course of a World Cup.
Yeah, it is. But I think actually India have got a pretty good record of tinkering with their side.
Cody likes to tinker, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. So I sort of think that the team and the squad will be used to that. But it's certainly, I think, in the last week or so, I just sense, and this could be a comment that is going to come back to bite me, but I sense that maybe the pressure is slightly getting to them. So obviously Afghanistan, they beat Afghanistan, but that was a close game, could have gone either way. They've obviously lost to England today. Again, wasn't as commanding a performance. You know, I think they lost their first wicket in the 30th over. They were on 180, I think, and fell short of probably 350 that they should have got. Bangladesh let them get away with it, but against a better team, they won't get away with that sort of mistake. So Yeah, also I think Kohli's comments about the short boundary, trying to deflect a bit from what was sort of a strange batting performance in the last 15 overs against England. Yeah. I just think there is a slight hint that everything isn't going quite according to plan as it was before. So, you know, that may come back to bite me. But, you know, that's, I think, just a little bit of a chink there.
Well, I as you say, that they've had success with tinkering with their side, but it felt to me that it was, first of all, a bit of an admission that they'd got things wrong against Dillon, because they were playing at the same ground. They switched from two spinners to three seamers and a spinner. And I just thought, to me, Kohli is such a kind of a hyperactive cricketer who's never satisfied. And it's part of the reason why he's such a phenomenal batsman. He always wants more. And I wonder with his team selection whether there's something more. He can't just settle for what he's got. He always thinks there's something extra he can get. And I do think that creates a bit of uncertainty inside. The fact they've switched from, everyone at start tournament was saying, brilliantly balanced attack, two spinners, two pacers, and now they've gone from three pacers to one spinner. Are they going to stick with that for the rest of the tournament?
I don't think they will. I think they figured that they could probably be at about, no disrespect to Bangladesh, but they could probably have been at 70%, 80% and still beaten them. So worth giving it a go with the balance. I just think with their two spinners, and just please remind me of their bowler who kind of comes at an awkward angle, kind of crouches low, is that Jadhav?
Oh, Jadhav, who was
With him bowling four or five overs, it does make a complete attack. I don't think this attack is probably one that they would want in the semis.
You can't rely on Pandya to bowl 10 overs every game.
No, I don't think so. And also, you talk about the tinkering and how he's never satisfied. I wonder if the tinkering is actually a result of him looking for something else. You know, there hasn't been 100 at number four for however many games. There certainly hasn't been 100 at five or six. So the tinkering is perhaps to try and, you know, jostle things around and kind of hope that in that jostling something new forms. But they are, yes, it might be different personnel, but I kind of still see them winning the game in the same way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, Pant batted nicely for his, 40 odds today at number four.
48.
I saw Yuvraj Singh tweet, "I think we found our number four." I mean, he will be, the 13th? I think they've tried over the last kind of year or so. So they're going to have to land him at some point. I mean, I think English fans, having seen Pant here last summer in the Test Series, were kind of flabbergasted that they couldn't find a spot for him in their ODI side. And then even more so now that Kartik has been here the whole time. Pant was picked ahead of him. Kartik comes in today, doesn't do much. It seems an increasingly odd pick. Odd non-pick.
It does, and it's just, that's just, still, I couldn't get over the decision at the time not to bring Pant here in the original squad, and I think that's turned out to be the same, to have turned out to be just a strange decision. But bringing him in, actually, I think they've arrived at the position everyone else thought they should be in having him in the team, and I think at number four, he's the best option they've got at number four. So I think they've sort of stumbled on that. But interestingly, on the spinners, if they do play England in the semi-final or the final, I think England have got the number over those spinners. If you remember back to last summer, England lost the first one-day international when I think
Kuldeep got saw them apart at Trent Bridge, didn't he?
Yeah. And he got five wickets, I think, in the T20 before that. But then Joe Root got 200s in the next two games and England just played them out. They smashed them the other day. So I actually think maybe there's a bit of a feeling now in India's camp that if they play England, should they play two spinners? Because I think in the last three games they played them so well. So, it's just... The only thing is, once you've got Rohit Sharma in your side and you've got Virat Kohli in your side and you've got Bumrah in your side, it's still going to take a very, very good team to beat you.
Right, well, we have touched on England, but we haven't actually talked about tomorrow's match, which is a rather big one at Durham. England v New Zealand, a place in the semi-final at stake. I think people said the last game against India was England's biggest game in one-day cricket since 1992 World Cup final. I mean, this one has to be that now, right?
Is every game going to be the biggest one?
Well,
since
I think it probably is from this point on. So, do we think England, from having seen the highlights against India on Sunday, England looked excellent, I thought, with bat and mostly with the ball as well. Do we think they've got over a blip and that they can see off New Zealand tomorrow?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think the return of Jason Roy is a big thing psychologically as well as just for, you know, he's been in great form throughout the summer. I think it's just a big psychological boost. We maybe can get on to talk about him and Bairstow at the top of the order. But I felt like that performance against India was far more of the England we've seen over the last 4 years, just being really aggressive, really positive, taking the positive option on. Whereas I felt like against Australia particularly, they're just a bit timid, a bit nervous, as if things were closing in on them. And I do think there's question marks over New Zealand. You know, they've had a decent tournament so far, but they had a pretty easy start. They had the game against India washed out.
Yeah.
They've had some close games against West Indies, Bangladesh, and obviously I thought their performance against Australia was just very strange. I mean, I think out of their top batsmen, only one of them, Kane Williamson, scored at a strike rate above 55, which is remarkable. Right? I just thought that was really strange. Yeah. So I think England have turned a corner, and I actually don't think New Zealand are. They're still a good side. They've still got good players, but I don't think they're quite as good as maybe we thought they were earlier in the tournament.
Yeah, because they went 6 games unbeaten to start with, but did have those easier comparatively fixtures at the start. We always thought it could get a little bit tight for them at the end, and now lost their last two. Yeah, and as you say, I mean, I always thought the start, their batting looked too reliant on Williamson and Taylor. And Taylor's done okay without doing great. Williamson obviously being absolutely brilliant. But you look at their averages, Williamson averaging 114 for the tournament. Jimmy Neesham, 46, helped by a not out in the last innings, but has done very well for them. No one else above 40. And then you've got Guptill, 26. Munro, 25. Latham, 8. Yeah, who's played every
game. Their openers have been a problem. You look at the other teams, they're in thereabouts in the semis, and their openers have really stood up. The Kiwis have been the one side who haven't really got off to consistently good starts, and you'd imagine that the English new ball bowlers would kind of, you know, be sizing them up, and that's not really something you fear. And if you get them two down for about 30-odd, whatever the case is, yes, Williamson and Taylor are great, but there is a lot of pressure on them because, unlike England, there isn't much coming through afterwards. It's interesting how New Zealand have gone, because at the start of the tournament, and certainly when they got on that run and after they beat South Africa, I thought, well, you know, here's maybe, you know, they're not just the dark horses. These guys would be worthy champions. But it's interesting, you kind of, you know, to go to a boxing metaphor, you kind of think a guy is a superstar knockout artist, and suddenly he comes across someone who can punch equally hard, and he gets, you know, you realize that, oh, he had a glass chinnies at half his career. That's kind of how New Zealand are shaping up. So I do worry for them. But, you know, again, getting back to England, their propensity for big fluctuations is something that still kind of stays to the side. You kind of think that they could still be rolled, the way Bolt's ability to move the new ball both ways and bring it back into the right-hander. You know,
and he's got form against England
exactly,
previously.
Exactly, he could run through the side. So it's not a gimme, but I still think England should win it.
Who do you want to win, Dan? That's not kind of a childish question. But
I'd like to see a new winner. You mean the whole tournament?
I mean England, New Zealand. Oh, but, well, both.
England, New Zealand. New Zealand. I have a softer spot for them. I quite like this England cricket team. I can't stand the rugby team.
Right, that's a good divergence.
Yeah, I can't stand the rugby team.
Or the weather, or the food.
And I don't mind the footballers, but I quite like this. I quite like the cricketers. I think they represent I think it was Vish in Crickbuzz, or it could have even been you, Rob, who said that this England team kind of represents a multiracial, kind of modern England, and I quite like that. Either of those sides winning the tournament, I just don't want Australia or India to win it. Personally, you know, as a fan taking my unbiased journalist hat off for a second, I'd like to see a new winner. So either England or India.
Okay. Well, I'm disappointing you haven't gone for England there. I thought that's what I was leading up to, but it's fine. We want honesty. No, we want honesty. Dan, I promised that if you came on the show, then I wouldn't ask you about South Africa, but that was a lie, I'm afraid. I'm going to ask you about South Africa. Right. It feels like South Africa have been knocked out of this tournament for such a long time. You've been covering the games. How has it been? And what's your, from being over here, what's your sense of the mood back home? Is everyone kind of weary of the thing, or is anger still keeping them going?
Anger, not so much. People were angry after the Bangladesh defeat. People were less angry after the India defeat because it was expected. People were angry after the New Zealand defeat. I think now, given the break, and especially that they've performed against not a great Sri Lanka side, but they performed against them. You know, the old guard stood up. It's a feeling of frustration of what might have been a feeling that, yes, they weren't coming here with much expectation, but we expected more than this. It's not necessarily the results that have rankled, but rather the manner of the defeats. Weariness, frustration, dejection. It's not all these sad mopey words that I can throw out there. It hasn't been received one, and the under-19 side isn't doing very well either. There's problems at the board level. The South African Cricketers Association are taking cricket South Africa to court over the domestic restructuring. So there's just a feeling of of despondency around cricket South Africa. There's not much positives coming through, and a lot of journalists are kind of scrambling for some feel good stories in the development setup. And there are feel good stories if you go and search them. It's been difficult, obviously, over here looking back home, but yeah, a feeling that this isn't quite rock bottom yet, and I think that's really what worries. You know, after the big chokes of 99, and you know, perhaps the misplaced chutzpah of 2007, you kind of felt that, yes, this is the pits, but there are the players, and there are the players at the domestic level to bounce back up. And you look around, you kind of feel like, well, this might not be the worst of it.
I'm interested in that anger angle, because I noticed before the Sri Lanka game, JP Duminy apologised. And I think it was here after the Bangladesh game, and we were both here in the press conference. One of the South African journalists asked the question of Faf. I think it was his first or second question of the press conference. You know, what would you say to the South African fans you've, you know, let down? He didn't say that, but in as many words. And I find that quite strange. And I think I tweeted this, and I got a bit of a mixed reaction, that I don't see why professional players who are putting the effort in, who just perform badly, should be apologising. But it was interesting to me that it sort of seemed expected. And I just wonder if you think that has been generally a factor of this team, of the expectation and weighing them down.
So I don't think it's just this team. I agree with you. I don't think that JP Duminy owed the nation an apology. I mean, owed the nation, a collective of 54 million people that speak 9 official languages. I mean, one guy's performance who's hardly played, that doesn't owe anyone an apology. You know, they want to perform. They're elite athletes. They're trying to do their job as best they can. No one came here wanting to lose. But the owing the nation an apology or giving thanks to the nation is something that stems from the new South Africa, from Nelson Mandela's Rainbow Nation Kool-Aid that we all drank in the early 90s. You know, I myself, you know, you cut me open, I bleed the rainbow, you know, like the good South African I am. There's a sense that our sports teams represent more than just a sports team. They represent hope. They represent a fractured nation who, on the day, our best 11 can beat the best 11 of England, a first world country with all their resources and history of empire and colonialism, etc. So when a journalist asked JP Duminy, do you want to apologize to the nation, or Faf, what do you think you would like to say to the nation? They're really kind of asking them to speak into that narrative that was first developed in the early 90s by Mandela. And I think that wave has crashed. I think that rainbowism, you know, just to kind of go off on a tangent if I can, I think that rainbowism has been proven to be a myth under the 9 years under Jacob Zuma, where millions of people, mostly black people, are still living in townships. So I don't think that rainbowism exists, but the myth of it still does, and especially on the sports field.
Well, that the 95 Rugby World Cup final, I mean, that was, I guess, the kind of embodiment of that. The timing couldn't have been better. You had the Mandela, Francois Pienaar wearing the Mandela
shirt. That's right. And in 96, the year after, South Africa's Bafana, the football team, won the African Cup of Nations, hosting it for the first time. Their first time playing in it, I think. I stand to be corrected, but I think it was their first time playing in the African Cup of Nations. So the Olympics of 94, Penny Haynes, Josiah Chongwane, I know I've pronounced his name incorrectly there, I apologize, winning gold in, where was the games? Was it Barcelona? Whatever 94 was. Atlanta? Somewhere. Those games were, there was great success. Ernie Els winning gold. I was like, we've emerged from this darkness, and the real people who are representing and showing that we belong here on the world stage again are our athletes. So when they struggle, it hurts. It we feel it. I mean, I don't know if you have been in the press box, but that after the New Zealand game, man, people were depressed. It was a depressed group of people.
Well, it's great that people care this much. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I completely agree with you. I think players coming out and apologising is unnecessary. But, you know, JP Duminy, he's a very impressive bloke, and I know he does a lot of good things outside of cricket. And he obviously felt some guilt. I don't think it was false, but he doesn't really he doesn't owe anyone anything. I don't
know. And there's no harm in doing it, right? It's not a harmful thing. It just struck me as I can't imagine somebody ask. Well, maybe that will happen, but I can't imagine somebody asking Owen Morgan in a press conference, "What do you say to the?" Maybe it might happen. You know, would you like to apologise? I just don't think that would happen. I don't know.
I also think Owen Morgan would be. He's a savvy bloke. I don't think there's any apology coming. I think he would say we've lost a cricket match because we haven't played very well, which is obviously.
See, and just to stay on the point just a little longer, you say that you don't see any harm. I actually disagree. I think there is harm in that because I think it continues to espouse this falsehood that athletes, by virtue of wearing a flag on their shirt, are now all of a sudden ambassadors. And in that piece that I wrote on for the magazine a while back now on athlete activism, I think that. In South Africa, especially in South Africa, people claim representation too easily, but remain blind or willfully blind to the struggles of the people back home. So I think if you're going to apologize to the nation for losing a cricket match, there needs to be more done outside of cricket. But maybe, as you say, JP has that right because of all the good work he does. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to seg from that, really, because it's now the betting segment of the show. So there's no link. There's no link at all. So I'm just going to go straight into it. Over the course of the World Cup, we have been chatting to Betfair's betting experts to find out where the smart money lies. And earlier, I spoke to Ed Hawkins, who shared some tips for the week ahead. Ed, thanks for joining us as ever. I believe you've got 3 or 4 tips for us for the week ahead.
Yeah, so just kicking off with England against the Kiwis. First up, we'll keep it brief. There's a couple of big shouts going in this game, which are what we'd call pure value, where the bookies have got the odds a little bit wrong. Okay. Ross Taylor top bat at 7-2 for the Kiwis, and Lockie Ferguson at 10-3 for the top wicket taker for New Zealand. They're just a little bit out of what they should be in terms of their hit rate over the last 2 years and how often they win their market.
Okay, very interesting. And then looking further ahead in the week?
Yeah, I suppose the big game coming up really after that is Afghanistan-West Indies. That's a clash which will interest the punters, because a lot of people are going to be wanting to get on the Afghans at about 7-2 with Betfair for this one. And you know, you can make a case for them, I think. I know they've had some issues in the camp and their batting has been a bit reckless and ill-disciplined at times, and obviously, they should have beaten Pakistan after that late implosion with some funny decision-making. But West Indies aren't really setting the world alight. You know, they've just failed to beat Sri Lanka, and they were very, very short odds to beat Sri Lanka in that game. So they must have let down an absolute army of punters, because they were backed into extremely short odds. And we just think they're a little bit one-dimensional, West Indies. You know, they can be big and brutish with the bat and the ball, but there doesn't seem to be a hell of a lot of nuance to their game. And on a wicket which might help the Afghan spinners, and there's an army of them, maybe the West Indies could get a little bit bogged down, might not be able to go for their big shots. And there's some room in that Afghanistan price, you know, at 7-2 for a sit down in front of the TV and a bit of a roller coaster ride, or maybe you could even trade that in running for some profits. So Afghanistan are catching our eye at 7-2 in that one.
And that one's at Headingley, isn't it? And I see that West Indies have been in good positions and struggled to get over the line. I quite like a bit of that as well.
Oh, you're right, they're not getting over the line in games, you know, and I just don't think they've got the smarts. So Afghanistan are value.
And your next one?
Pakistan, Bangladesh, we're going to go for the outsider again here. How typical would it be of Pakistan to have done all this hard work to get themselves back into the contention for the semi-finals and then chuck it away at the last? I think Bangladesh are, you know, they're a durable outfit. They are a little bit reliant on Shakib, but they've got plenty of fight in them. And the way they pegged back India when they looked like they were going to get 400 on Tuesday was impressive. So I think they'll give Pakistan a really tough game here, and I think I'm right in saying that Bangladesh have won the last 4 in the head-to-head.
Right, okay, interesting.
When you're looking at odds of 4-9 Pakistan, it's a price to turn your nose up at, really. If there's one rule of cricket betting, it's never ever bet Pakistan at odds on. And I'll be taking them on all day long at those prices. Bangladesh to go well in that one. And you can get about 9-5 with Betfair, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for the likes of Shakib to come to the party again, and maybe Tamim to get involved, and Mushfiqur. You know, and we're talking about these players just reeling off names. These are good players, you know. Yeah. Shreyas Murtaza, great competitor. Mustafir the Fizz, 5 wickets against India on Tuesday. So very happy to be with Bangladesh.
Brilliant. Ed, is that it? Have you got another one for us this week?
Well, we're moving in Saturday, really, and then we've got a couple of mismatches, I think. Sri Lanka versus India, not really floating our boat. India have been a little bit up and down in games, but getting the job done eventually. Apart from that, go slow against England. Australia, South Africa isn't a great match odds bet, but we'll probably be looking for top back bets in that one. If we can get on David Warner, maybe at about 11-4 for top run scorer honours, that'll be a decent bet. Him and Aaron Finch are having a real ding dong battle for top Australian run scorer in the tournament. And sure. Overall tournament run scorer, and that's a really great betting heat because it's basically between those two.
Well, thanks as ever for your expertise, Ed. We'll see how those go over the course of the next week.
All right, cheers, Joe.
So, from the expert to the amateurs, now it's time for the always eagerly awaited Phil v Joe challenge. If you're new to this, at the start of the World Cup, Betfair Exchange gave £100 each to Phil and I to bet over the course of the tournament, with any funds remaining being donated to the charity Chance to Shine, who are taking the game to schools and communities around the country. As it stands, I'm not doing very well. Phil's doing slightly better. Now, you may have noticed Phil's not actually here today. That's because he's sunning himself in Ibiza. Allegedly, it's his sister's wedding or something. But he was good enough to pick up the phone when I called him earlier. And these are our bets for the week. Joining me on the line from Ibiza is Phil Walker. Phil, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, thank you, Joe. I'm just lounging by the pool, quite literally. But obviously focusing on my cricket bets.
Quite enough of that. Let's move straight on to your bets. Let's start with, let's quickly run down how we're going on our tournament bets so far. Have you got anything still live?
Well, very much so. Rohit Sharma, I got 20s on the exchange initially, and he is now far and away, but he is now number one, 544 runs. We are chatting midway through the India-Bangladesh game, so Shakib could conceivably haul him in with, I think, a 70-odd, but Sharma at 544 is currently out in front, and then there's those two Aussies, the flies in the ointment for me, really. Warner is 40 behind him and Finch is 28 behind. Mm. And the other bet, of course, the famous bet that I talk of every day of my life, is Joe Root in England at 33-1. And Root is in that pack. Root's made 476 runs so far in the tournament. Obviously, the New Zealand-England game to come.
Yeah.
So Root is very much in the mix. And I see the top run scorer in the tournament being from those four, really. I think it's Sharma, Warner, Finch, or Root. Barring something spectacular with Bangladesh getting through to the semis, I see those four battling it out. I have fears that Warner and or Finch are going to ruin this one for me, but at the moment I'm very much engaged with this, and those two are conceivable to come in. 33-1 Root in England, double Sharma 20-1.
And what's the one that's fallen away? We can't just have you sounding like you've done well here.
Does sound that, doesn't it? Quinton de Kock.
Quinton de Kock, of course. We need to bring that up every week just to remind listeners. I'll very quickly run through mine because there's not much live here at all. Jason Roy to be leading run scorer, about 260 behind Rohit Sharma, so that looks a stretch. Trying to be Wooden Spoon, not happening. Pat Cummins to be leading wicket taker, which was one looking pretty good at one stage, but he's 12 behind Mitchell Stark now, so that's not happening either. But I will say,
start far and away, Joe. Start far and away now.
He's seven ahead of the nearest rival. And he's 12 ahead of Cummins. So yeah, I think he's probably got that one wrapped up. But I will say, I won a bet last week. One of my last my weekly bets. I had Pakistan down to beat New Zealand, which they did. So made a little profit there. So it's not all bad news.
I stupidly, Joe, just on that one, I came in on a double. I had Australia to be beaten by England and Pakistan to beat New Zealand. So I was half right, but obviously that doesn't amount to anything. I bummed out completely last week, incidentally. I didn't make a pretty penny at
all. Right, good. Well, that's excellent news. That is what this challenge is all about. So, all right, Phil, tell me, how are you shaping up for this week? What have you gone for?
Okay, I've got four lined up. I know conceivably it should be three, but I've got four lined up here. I have a rather audacious double at 12-1. Okay, and I've gone on I've gone on Afghanistan to beat the West Indies. I think the West Indies, that they are home. They are fed up with this tournament. And Afghanistan have been pushing hard to get that win under their belt. Obviously, they ran India close. They ran Pakistan close. I can see possibly Afghanistan turning the West Indies over, especially with the spinners as well. They are their trump cards, of course, for Afghanistan. The West Indies, and they don't fancy the spinners too much. The middle order doesn't play them as well as they do the pace. So I can possibly see that. And Bangladesh to beat Pakistan, this is predicated on England beating New Zealand. I think if England beat New Zealand, yeah, Pakistan will be so down that Bangladesh, who are an equivalent side anyway, I think it's a shootout between those two teams. I fancy Bangladesh. The odds are considerably better for Bangladesh to win than they are for Pakistan, so I'm going on a double there. Bangladesh 12-1. Kohli to be top run scorer in India's final game, he's due. You know, it's remarkable, really, that he hasn't made 100 yet.
That's Sri Lanka on Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Kohli to run away with it. I can't see Sharma getting yet another 100, so I'm saying Kohli to make his first three-figure score of the tournament so far. You can get him around 9-4, perhaps 10-3. I'm going to go for Warner and de Kock as a double to be top runs in the final group game, South Africa-Australia. At 4-1, you're going to get him around 4, maybe 5. And the one I'm really fancying is coming up in the England-New Zealand game. It's Williamson and Root to make 50 each at 4-1. That's on Sportsbook. Okay. So Williamson and Root to make 50 apiece, 4-1 Sportsbook.
I like that one. I have to say, you're sticking with your doubles, not warned off by your last week's failures. But that's good, staying confident. On mine, I've actually also got Afghanistan to beat West Indies at 4.5 on the exchange. Similar thinking to yours. I think West Indies keep getting good positions and then imploding. I also just think this match will mean a huge amount to Afghanistan and perhaps not quite as much to West Indies. So I could see them nicking that one at 4-5 on the exchange. Those are really, really tasty odds as well. I've got in tomorrow's match, or today's match if you're listening to it on Wednesday, England-New Zealand, England leading wicket taker Liam Plunkett at 7-2 on Sportsbook. Adara McGroundy knows well, he took 3 wickets v India. He's still got a point to prove after being left out earlier in the tournament. And I think he looks in really, really good shape at the moment and just always seems to take wickets in those middle overs. So I think that's a nice one. And then
he was brilliant, of course, on Sunday as well, Plunkett. You know, he really held that innings together. It was a good shout to bring him back into the team. I mean, I think he probably plays from here on in, doesn't he, in this side, however far it goes in the tournament.
I think that's probably right. I think it's now coming back down to Wood or a spinner to miss out, I would guess. But I expect them to go with Wood and Plunkett and Moen to set out against New Zealand. Although this, when people were listening to this, the match might have already started and we just sound stupid, so we should probably move on from this a little bit. And then my final one, odds aren't up on Sportsbook yet, but they will be shortly. I'm backing Rohit Sharma again to top score for India v Sri Lanka on Saturday, probably at about 3-1. He's got 400s already in the World Cup, with the possible exception of Malinga. I don't see Sri Lanka's attack unduly troubling him, and he keeps getting a bit of luck as well. Root dropped him in the game on Sunday. Tamim dropped him today. I think it feels like everything's going Rohit's way, so I'm going to stick with him, and he's done me well in this tournament so far. So those are my bets for the week ahead.
Well, may the best man fail slightly easier than the other man. Best of luck, Joe. I hope you're enjoying London town in the heat wave. I'm going to get back to my sun lounger and speak to you in a few days.
All right, sickening. Have a good time.
Cheerio, good luck.
Bye. Okay, before we finish up, Dan and Rob, tell me what you're looking forward to over the course of the next week. Rob, what you start?
I'm actually looking, and I guess this might not materialise, but I would quite like England and Australia to play another game, because, for as I mentioned earlier, I think in the knockout phases it would be good for England to actually have a go at Australia. I think the game at Lord's last week, as I said, I think England were timid. I don't think they really put enough pressure on Australia. And I think just sort of throwing it forward for the rest of the summer, we got the Ashes coming up after the World Cup, hot on the heels. I just think if we could have a really good semi-final game or final between those those two teams, England playing far better, Australia playing really well, you know, best team wins, but with both teams going hammer and tong, I just think that would set up the summer more. You know, obviously it's got its own context for the World Cup, but I think it would set the summer up, and I think it would also, for the Ashes, just, you know, create a few little battles. So, you know, there's going to be that bowling attack for Australia in this tournament are going to be the bedrock of the Ashes bowling attack. Will Jason Roy play in the Ashes? We don't know, but it would be great for him to make a statement against
that. Will
Finch
play in the Ashes as well?
Will Finch play? You know, so I think there's a lot of subplots, but I just think I was just disappointed in that game at Lord's, and I just, whoever wins, I just want a better game, and I would love them to meet up, because I do think if they do play each other in the knockout phases, I think England will just go for it because they'll have learnt the lesson from the previous game.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was at Lord's for that one, and it was just, Australia were brilliant, that has to be said. I thought they would just play the game perfectly, but England also kind of played into their hands a bit, and it was just a bit of a damp squib by the end. It was a very flat crowd. There wasn't any kind of sense of anger or frustration. It almost was like the crowd kind of lost interest halfway through as well. And those two sides you want to see going at each other, hammer and tongs. And hopefully, if England can beat New Zealand, then we might see that still yet to come.
Just staying on that game, because I was there too. If England go put in another performance like they did against Australia, I mean, it felt like a choke in a way. You know, you asked me earlier about South Africa and choking. Is there a danger that the side, if they don't put in another performance like they did against India, if they say they smash New Zealand, but they go out in the semi-finals or even the final in the manner that they did against Australia, would the choke label be attached to them?
I don't know if the choke word is so very much South African in cricket now. I think we're probably
trying to pass it on.
Probably have to come up with a new one. I think it perhaps would exist.
Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. And I think it would to an extent because England have come in as favourites and we've trumpeted this side for 3 or 4 years now. So it would have to feel a bit like that. I think really at the start, England had to get to the final for it to be considered a good effort on their part. Didn't necessarily have to win it because you can get beaten by anyone on their day, but I think they had to get to the final for it to be considered success. So that still could happen. I guess as well, if they go out now having lost a few games earlier on, then actually their win-lose record at the end is going to be, well, this wasn't the form of a top side at all. Had we got overexcited, were they actually that good? So yeah, it's all still up for grabs. I think it could still end up looking like a big disappointment, even if they do get past this New Zealand hurdle.
Yeah, and I think if they don't get over that hurdle tomorrow, then I think it would be more of a choke, to use that word, than actually if they got to the semi-final and lost in a one-off game. Because I think actually, you know, to lose to Pakistan, then lose to Sri Lanka, then lose to New Zealand in games actually against three teams that, you know, on paper, and I know cricket's not played on paper, but on paper that they should be winning, I think that would ask more questions. And actually, if they got to the semi-final and where David Warner scored a magnificent 100 and knocked them out. So I actually, in a way, think there's a bit more pressure on tomorrow's game for them than actually if they get through. And that's why I sort of say if they do get through, I can see them just freeing up because, you know, that I feel like the pressure will be off a little bit. But let's not forget, they have been the world number one team. They have beaten anyone who's come near them for 4 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be a disappointment were they not to get to the final. And I think then you'd have to ask questions of sort of preparation and, you know, mentally, were they in the right spot? And I know they've had a few injuries and stuff. But so in a weird way, I think tomorrow's actually more pressurised than the knockout stages. Actually.
Yeah, I can see that. And just before we finish, Dan, what are you looking forward to over the course of this week?
Well, I was inspired by, and I'm not just saying because he's here, but a piece by Rob on CricBuzz, where he wrote beautifully on the battle between Malinga and Hashim Amla at the game against Durham, which is a gorgeous ground, by the way. I really enjoyed my time there. I'm excited to see some legends bow out, and I'd like to see the reception that they get. I mean, in South Africa, you've got Imran Tahir, you've got JP Duminy, Hashim Amla playing their last World Cups, couple all over the place, Chris Gayle, Malinga himself. Yeah, so I'm just quite keen to see how these guys put in one final performance, and I hope the crowds really get up for them. And, you know, not many players, as we've seen with Dale Steyn, get to bow out of a World Cup on their feet, and I hope that the crowds rise to the occasion and give them the send-off they deserve.
Lovely. Well, that's a lovely place to finish it, I think. The Wisden Cricket Daily podcast will be back tomorrow. I'm going to be joined by New Zealand reporter Andrew Alderson and Ben Jones of Cricviz to look back on that huge match at Durham. Let's see if the ever cheerful Ben is still smiling come stumps tomorrow. This has been the Wisden Extra podcast in partnership with Betfair Exchange. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or all the other usual platforms.